doing right now is known as Elul. And perhaps the most famous acronym that's connected with the time of Elul, which really describes the theme and the mood of the month, is found in the sixth chapter of Shir Hashirim, a Song of Songs. It's in source number one. Ani l'dodi v'dodi li haro'eh b'shoshanim. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine, who pastures among the roses. And the first letters of this phrase, ani, the aleph, l'dodi, the lamed, the vav in v'dodi, and the lamed in li, spell out the word Elul, the Hebrew month, which we're standing in presently, the last month of the year, right before the high holiday season. And our rabbis describe what is the mood of this month, what is the theme of Elul. The theme of Elul is Ani l'dodi v'dodi li, I am to my beloved, and my beloved is to me. It's a time of love, a time of closeness, a time of intimacy with God. As our rabbis describe it, that the king is in the field, and all who want to come and approach him, it's accessible to everybody. The first question I'd like to deal with this morning is, how does this relationship manifest itself? I am to my beloved. What does that mean, that I am to my beloved? In what way do we express this emotion that we are close to God? And that's a central question I'd like to deal with this morning. The second question is the first word, ani, I. Judaism places so much emphasis not so much on the individual, but rather on the individual within the community, and the individual within the community's relationship to God. How then are we to understand this focus of Ani l'dodi? It almost seems like a private relationship of I am to my beloved. Why is there this emphasis of the Ani, of the individual, and this special closeness and intimacy with God? The third question I'd like to touch on today, will answer at the end of the shiur with God's help, is a law that's found in Parshat Shofti, in the parsha we read yesterday. It's a law of setting aside three cities, which are cities of refuge if one murdered, God forbid, by accident. And if someone would do this, example that the Torah gives, if you're out in the forest and you're chopping down a tree, and either the axe goes flying or the tree goes flying and hits somebody, and they die, God forbid. So you clearly do not mean to kill this person. You flee to a city of refuge, which is one of the cities of the Levites, and one would remain there. It's almost like tag, you're safe, nobody could touch you, until the high priest would die, and then one would be allowed to go back home. So there were three cities set up on one side of the Jordan for the 2.5 tribes who lived there, and three cities set up in the land of Israel proper. And then the Torah tells us in Parshat Shofti, which is found in source number 3, a very, very intriguing aspect. And when God will enlarge your border, as he has sworn to your fathers, which will come about when you observe the whole of this commandment, which I command you this day, which is clearly a reference, as our rabbis understand it, to the times of Messiah, to love the Lord your God and to walk in his ways, then, at this time, the time of the Messiah, you shall add a further three cities to these cities. So instead of having three cities in the land of Israel, you'll have six cities in the land of Israel. To which Rabbi Miller and Shabbat Shirim asked the obvious question. What do you mean that when the time of the Mashiach comes, when the time of the Messiah comes, I'm going to add three cities? What would we expect to happen when the Mashiach comes? No cities at all. Not only would there not be an extra three cities, we would have maybe perhaps that there should be no need for cities. Right? Is this, as Rabbi Miller brings down, in source number 4, is this not the time where the wolf will dwell peacefully with the lamb? And many similar prophecies, this type of murder or deliberate murder is inconceivable at this time. What do you mean we're going to add cities? So there's an approach of the Meshech Chochma, famous biblical commentator, a Meir Simcha of Divinsk, who lived at the beginning of the century, who offers a very fascinating insight. And he says, and I'm summarizing source 6 and 7 now, he says we know that there are two possibilities when the Mashiach could come. One is Be'ita, in its right time, which means there's an appointed date in history when the Mashiach is going to have to come, whether we deserve it or not. And then there's a time called Achishena that if we're really worthy, so God will bring the Mashiach closer. It will happen sooner. It could happen today. If we are worthy right now, in an hour from now, right this minute, Mashiach could come. So says the Meshech Chachma the following. He says, based on this distinction, that if the Mashiach were to come in its proper time, whatever date that is in history, so then we have all the prophecies of the lying down with the Lamb, a time of peace, and really, indeed, there'd be no need to add these three cities. However, if it comes earlier, because we are worthy, so then the period of Mashiach will resemble very much the period we're living in now, except Shibud Malchios Bilvad, that the only difference is that the nation of Israel will no longer be subjugated to the rule of others. And in such a case, since the world will really be going in its natural course in order, which is fascinating to understand in its own right, we'll need these three cities. So again, we look at the Meshech Chachma and we have the same question. If the Jewish people are bringing the Mashiach, which means they're on a level of deserving, it means they're on a high spiritual level. So then we would think if they're on a high spiritual level, we would need the three extra cities. But in fact, we see the opposite. That when we're not on that level, Mashiach comes when it comes, so then we don't really need these cities. But when we bring it and we deserve it, oh, so then we need these three cities. So what are these three cities doing here? So those are three questions for the morning. How is the relationship of Ani L'Dodi, I am to my beloved, manifested? Why the focus in Ani, I? And why the necessity when the time of Mashiach comes, a time of peace, a time where, according to Meshech Chachma, it's a time when we're going to bring Mashiach ourselves. Why is there a necessity for three extra cities? Why not have them completely removed? Okay. Let's take a look at the first two questions. And then at the end, we'll get to, I think, the third question. I'd like to begin with an understanding of the Sfas Emes, famous Hasidic Rebbe from Gur, on what Elul, this time of year, this month, is all about. And I think, in source number 10, he says it the most succinctly of anybody. Ki ikar ha-tshuva tzarich liyot al ze lizkur ki nishtachalnu ba'olam hazeh Says the Sfas Emes, we all know that the month of Elul, a time of ratzon, a time of desire between man and God, is a time of tshuva, a time of repentance, preparing ourselves for Rosh Hashanah. What is the tshuva, what is the repentance at this time? So says the Sfas Emes, the repentance is that we need to remember that we're put on this world for a purpose. And the purpose is to serve God. Uman continuing intent, shitrudim behav leolam. And the fact that we get caught up in all the details of life, the shochachim haikar, and we forget what is the essence. Al zet tzarich liot ikar ha-tshuva. This is the essence of tshuva. Lachzor lekabel ol ha'avdu liot mukhan rak lasor ufano yiparach. To be able to return and accept upon ourselves the yoke of God. And if we accept this yoke, Ani L'Dodi, if we take the initiative and meet God and accept this yoke, then L'Dodi leaves and God will respond and have this relationship reciprocate. How is this accomplished? What is it that we need to do to accept the yoke of God on us? That's like a wonderful concept, right? It's almost like we go outside and say, okay, God, we're ready to accept the yoke of heaven on us. What does that mean practically? What do we do? How is this manifest? So I'd like to speak about a structure which I mentioned and discussed in length last year in our Elul Shiur. The same structure, but I'm going to develop it this year, completely different than last year. It's the structure, again, of the Sfas Emes, who says that the theme of Elul, and this is what we will work with today, source number 11, Heirish Achodesh Elul Sheheim Lo V'lo Anachnu Kri Yuchsiv Mizmor L'Toda. Let's explain what the Sfas Emes means. It is gorgeous. The 100th chapter in the Psalms, Kapitel Kuf, is known as Mizmor L'Toda, a Psalm of Thanksgiving. And in this Psalm, we have the following verse. Serve Hashem with gladness. Come before Him with joyous song. Know that Hashem, He is God. And this is where it's underlined in Source 12. It is He who made us, and we are his people and the sheep of his pasture. This expression, it is he who made us and we are his, lo anachnu is the Hebrew phrase. In the biblical text, we have a phenomena called the kri uchsi, and it happens a number of times in the Bible. It's a fascinating phenomena where the Torah writes a word one way and we read it a different way. And both the written as well as the oral way of understanding this text teaches myriads of lessons. So the text is written where it's circled in the Hebrew in source 12, v'lo anachnu with an aleph. Lo, lamed aleph means not. We are nothing. Zero, zilcho, zero. Lo anachnu, we're nothing. But how do we read it? We read it as lamed vav, the same word lo, but with an aleph it means we're nothing, and with a vav it means we are his. Totally different meaning. Lo anachnu means we're nothing. That's how it's written. How do we understand it? With a vav, lo anachnu, we are his. Says the Sfas Emes, you know what Elul's about? Elul's about this lo and lo anachnu. And if you take a look just at the first page, because it's in front of us, if we take a look at the title, the word Elul, those in the word Elul is encoded both of those lows. Let's look backwards in the word Elul in the Hebrew. Lamed Vav means lo, we are his. Then the next two letters, Lamed Aleph, means lo, we are nothing. That's the word Elul. Elul means, it's in the word itself, lo and lo, we are nothing and we are his. Continuing in the Sfas Emes, he says, Upeyush HaDavar, what does this mean? It's just linguistics. We are nothing. We are his. No. Hakol Lechan, it really means one and the same. Shekifi ma shelo anachnu, kein lo anachnu. As much as, and on the level that we're lo anachnu, we're nothing, it is on that level, commiserate to that, we're lo anachnu, we're his. The more bittul we have, the more self-nullification, the low with an aleph of nothing, the higher we can reach in this level, the higher than we can reach in the low anachnu with above, we are his. And I think that these two words, low, nothing, and low, we are his, form the two aspects of what Elul's about, the two aspects of tshuva. Let's understand. The first is probably the more famous approach to Elul. I want to deal with it very quickly because it's pretty well known. What does it mean, lo anachnu, we are nothing? It's a concept of bitul, it's a concept of nullification in front of God. If we turn to the writings of Soloveitchik Zatzal, an essay called Catharsis, source 13, Halacha, Jewish law, encourages man to pursue greatness, vastness, to experiment daringly with his liberty, to search feverishly for dominion. And again, Halacha, Jewish law, will command man to halt and to make an about face. This dialectical movement, no matter how incomprehensible to modern man, forms, as we stated above, the very heart of Jewish living. In a word, Jewish law teaches man how to conquer and how to lose, how to seize initiative, and how to renounce. And this is really true of all aspects that define us as people. Whether it's on the most base hedonistic level, this is source 16, the hungry person must forego the pleasure of taking food, no matter how strong the temptation. Men of property must forego the pleasure of acquisition if the latter is halachically and morally wrong. In a word, halacha requires a man that he possesses the capability of withdrawal. It means at times in life, lo anachnu, bitul, self-nullification, means that I have to give over my will to God's will. Which means as I'm starving and I really would like to eat this food, but it's not kosher. So I will step back and say, lo anachnu, bitul, I will nullify my will to God's will. I have a great deal, I can make a great business deal. Okay, it's not so ethical. You know, life isn't so ethical sometimes. No. Even though everyone else around me might be doing it, might not be doing it, it's irrelevant to me if it's improper to do, even though I can make a lot of money on it. Lo anachnu, I will subjugate my will to God's will. It works on, continuing in 17, on the emotional realm as well. I would where God tells us, do not covet, do not hate your brother in your heart. Sometimes you want to have these feelings, you need to step back and say no. And likewise in 18, on the cognitive level as well, wherein there's so many aspects of life that we don't understand, that remain a mystery, and we need to accept them as well. Lo anachnu means that we have to step back and say, there's somebody running this world aside from me, and I'm willing to give my will to his will. Elul is a time where we ask ourselves, have we been loyal to this? Have I given over this year my will to his will? Or has it been in looking back over the past year that my will has won out more than his will? And it happens every day in our life. Let's take a simple example. You have this great piece of gossip that you want to tell your friend, but it's just, you can't pass it up. I mean, it's really, you know, right from the top 10 of gossip of the year. So you say to yourself, I really have to tell this. I mean, this person really needs to know it. And then on the other hand, you say to yourself, well, God told me I shouldn't be saying this. So it's a tug of war. So 9 times out of 10, we all know what happens. Comes along Elul, and we say to ourselves, on those 9 times out of 10, could I have been more careful? I should be more careful. To be mekabel lo malchut shamayim, to accept God's kingship, means that I look back and say, whose will won out? I'd like to take a look at this concept of bitul one step further before we move on. And it's a fascinating insight, and this is source number 19 and 20, sources 19 and 20 in the Sifti Chaim of Chaim Friedlander. In Chelek Aleph, where he says a very fascinating and poignant idea. He says, "She'omnam ha'adam yotzer ba'atzmo ayidei mitzvotav et takdushan v'nafsho shu'a gan eden shelo." A person creates through his mitzvos, through his commandments, holiness and the Garden of Eden. And likewise, a person creates impurity and the Gehenim of his life. Says the Sifti Chaim, and it's really a fascinating point. He says, you want to know what your Gehenim or your Gan Eden is going to look like after 120 years? It's not some mystical concept of what is it going to look like. You want to know what Gan Eden and Gehenim look like? Take a look at yourself. You, as an individual, create your Gan Eden, you create your heaven, you create your Gehenna. Which means, every time you do a mitzvah, depending on how much effort you put into that mitzvah, that's what your Gan Eden looks like. And likewise, no matter depending on how much you put in to any aveira, any sin you do, that's what your Gehenna looks like. It's not some crazy concept. It's you. Take a look at yourself in the mirror, and that is a reliable gauge of what your future and what you are developing and creating in life. Continues the Sifti Chaim. The amount of tumah, the amount of impurity is a bad word, the amount of negativity might be a better word, that we create in our averos, in our negative actions, is really on a scale from really tremendous and really horrific to not so bad, even though what we do is negative. And the depending factor on how much negativity we create is dependent on how much of self we put into that action. Which means the following, putting it down into more simplistic terms. If a person is very much focused on self, so let's use very simplistic terms, he's like, or she is like, a blown-up image of self. And everything they do in life is focused around self. So let's imagine this grotesque image of blown-up self. So everything that I do, whether it's like one gets angry, one wants this, one wants that, one demands this, whatever it is, it's going to be not just I want this or I'm getting angry, it's going to be a blown-up anger, a blown-up desire. The more I diminish my view of self, so then when I get angry, or when I desire something, or when I do something I really shouldn't do, so then it's the same negative action, but it doesn't look so big, it doesn't look so disastrous, because the power and the punch that I put into it is that much less. And then on a deeper level, it's what the Lo Anachnu, the Bitul, is all about of Elul. where we need to realize who we are and put ourselves in perspective. And the more we're able to put ourselves in perspective, so that even though we perhaps may do sins, our sins are going to be of a less quality than if we look at ourselves on a much more blown up level. So the law of Nachsu we saw on two levels. One is, are we pitting our will against God's will, and is our will coming out stronger than God's will? And the second is looking at ourselves. Do we invest so much self into everything we do that it creates a stronger aspect of negativity in every sin that we do? Now, here's the bad news. It's not just a one-time process. I'm going to work on myself. And now that I've worked on myself, okay, I'm an easy street. Another 100 years, just coast along. Says Rav Dessler, and this is in the Chelek Beis, in the Michtam Eliyahu, he says, a person is either ole or yored, with the asterisks in 22, a person is either ascending or descending. There's no such thing as standing still. Look at 23, sanctuaries in time, where the asterisk is, when one is making progress in the life of the spirits, many doors open before him. But there is no standing still. If one thinks one is standing still, in truth, he is falling. This is our situation. We are falling continuously, but we don't know it. There's nothing worse than this. The example that's given very often is of a bird. If a bird flaps its wings, it's soaring. When a bird stops flapping its wings, it's not just not flapping its wings, it's descending. And this is really true of our relationship with God. There's no such thing as I'm coasting along, I'm standing still with my relationship with God. Either I'm working on it, and that means I'm moving forward, or I'm consciously not working on it, and that's falling, or, and this is the most dangerous of the options, I'm just not thinking about it. I'm living a very complacent life, and that's also falling. If you're not rising, you're falling. With this in mind, I'd like to take a look at the second aspect of tshuva and elul. And I think it's even scarier than the first aspect. This first aspect is clearly defined. I've done certain things wrong. I put my will over God's will, and that was wrong. And I can usually mark in my life when I've done such things. But then there's another aspect of elul, the lo anachnu, we are his with a vav. And there's another aspect of tshuva. Let's take a look. The Nesivos Shalom, he'll spell it out for us, source 24. He says on the verse, Nach besad rachenu v'nach kora, let us search out our ways and investigate where we have done wrong. D'lo kai al yanei chatein, this is not referring to sins. Ella, rather we need to do tshuva, let's listen very carefully, al kiyum ha-mitzvot v'amasim tovim v'al tarav v'atzvila. You know what we have to do tshuva for? Our good deeds. We have to do tshuva for davening. Do tshuva for the good actions we've done. Sounds a little strange. Yeah, let's go on. Ukimamar hayadua, as we know, shad tshuva al averot einav kasha koka kemo tshuva al mitzvos ma'asim tovim. It's much easier to do tshuva on what I've done wrong than tshuva on what I have done right. Why? He says the following. Ki l'chol ha'pachol leiv nishbar v'nikeh. When I do something wrong, at least I feel bad. I spoke that gossip. Now, after I spoke it, how do I feel? I feel like a louse. I shouldn't have done it. I know I shouldn't have done it. I just had to do it, but I know I shouldn't have done it. I feel bad. I really do. However, avo b'mitzvos harehu markish kiyem mitzvah v'no noten libo masho kilkel. I just said a blessing. Do I now sit down and say, oi, was that a bad blessing? Oi, do I feel bad? Oh yeah, I should have said that blessing better. No, how do I look? I said a blessing, I'm great. Let's try to develop this idea carefully, because I think it's a very challenging idea. And I think it's an idea that we need, if we're honest with ourselves as people who want to grow, we need to look at. Even within the realm of my relationship with God, of that which I do right. And for everyone in this room, that can be defined differently because we're all holding on different places. but whatever that may be for every individual, is this relationship the best that I can offer God or not? That's the question we need to ask ourselves. You know, if we look at our own lives, forget God, forget religion for a moment, we all have within our lives a longing and a striving to be the best we can. No one likes to be mediocre at their work. You want to be the best. You want to do the best job you can. You're embarrassed to hand in a mediocre piece of work. And even if you do, you'll really kick yourself and say, no, I could have done better. Next time I'm going to do better. Let's look at our own lives on a material level. Whatever it is, we're always saying, you know, I could redecorate the house. I could get a new car. I could make this a little bit nicer. Maybe I can't afford it now. But when I can't afford it, I'd like to do it. Why? Because we all have this striving within us to improve on every level. And we're not happy with the status quo. We want to make it better. Now we get back to religion. Let's bring religion and God back in now. Then we bring into religion and we say, you know what? Well, I davened this morning. I washed my hands before I ate. Well, what do you want from me? I did it. So if we're not satisfied with mediocrity in every aspect of our lives, the question becomes, well, why in this aspect of our lives are we happy? Just like we realize we need to improve in everything else, we need to realize that even in our relationship with God, there needs to be improvement. That's the tshuva of lo anachnu, we are His. But if we really want to be His and we want a relationship, so then let's take those aspects, the positive things that we do, and they're great, and let's bring them to a higher level of closeness. We turn to the next page, source number 29, the Alei Shur of Wavi, gives a great description of this. And he says, imagine you're standing in front of the high court, and they ask you, why did you do this certain action? And you respond, Stam, I just did it. And what were you thinking about when you did it? I don't know, I just did it. This is so true of our lives. We go through religion so often as a rote. And if someone asks us, well, why are we doing it? I don't know, I'm doing it. And what were you thinking about when you did it? I don't know, I just did it. Rav Dessler, in Michtam Eliyahu, translated Strive for Truth, edited by Rabbi Carmel, says that this level of observance is not the level that we should strive for. And he says, let's read together source 30, most people who are brought up in a life of mitzvot and good deeds do these things without depth of feeling or commitment. Now, it's true that God does not deny the reward of any creature, and they will certainly be rewarded for keeping to what they have learned. But if we are talking about elevated levels of mitzvah observance, these are almost completely absent. Continuing 31, the merits of a person are not those mitzvahs and good deeds to which he has been trained, but only his free acts of bechira, of free choice. The good acts he has been brought up to do are not his own. They merely serve to set the position of his free choice. Which means the following. If a person is brought up in observing Torah and mitzvot, so then I have no challenge whether I'm going to turn on the light on Shabbos or not. Because that's the way I was raised for 32 years of my life. I will get rewarded for keeping Shabbos, but it's really not a choice for me. If a person was not raised that way, or whatever a person, based on the way they were raised, now says, let me take a step further, and I have to struggle with it. It's a struggle whether I'm going to turn on the light on Shabbos or not. It's a struggle to eat kosher or not. It's a struggle to speak Lashon Hara or not. It's a struggle to have intention in davening or not, whatever it may be. It's on the level of struggle that one really gets rewarded. And he goes one step further, and it's brilliant. He says, do you know who really gets the reward for the fact that, for example, I don't turn on a light on Shabbos? It's not my reward. Who gets the reward? My parents. My teachers. Because they're the ones who had to work so hard to bring me to this level that I wouldn't turn on a light on Shabbos. And he brings as proof of this idea a fascinating, fascinating thing. I'd like to share it for a moment. It's brought down from Rav Nosson C. Finkel of Slobodka. And he says we learn it from the story of Lot. Lot, we know, was the nephew of Abraham. And we know that he was in the tutelage of Abraham for many years, and Abraham's king mark was that of Chesed, of good deeds. And the Torah tells us the story how God wanted to destroy the city of Sodom, and he sent down angels to come and take Lot and his family out. Lot invited these people to do terrible things to him, and Lot really put his life on the line to save these strangers. And then the Torah continues that God saved Lot from the city of Sodom, and he was able to escape. And our rabbis ask, well, what was it about Lot? What was the great aspect and the great attribute of Lot that made him deserving of the fact that he would be saved from Sodom? So we would anticipate the next line would be, he put himself out for these strangers. He nearly got himself killed for these strangers, and that was the reason he was saved. That's what we would expect. In fact, the Talmud, Rashi quotes the Talmud, says something totally different. Do you know what it was that Lot did that was so great that he was saved? It almost sounds funny. What was it? Many years earlier, Abraham and Sarah, who were married, went down to Egypt. And Abraham said to Sarah, hey, if people know we're married, they're going to kill me to get you. So let's say we're brother and sister. What was the greatness of Lot? Lot was present at that time, and he knew that they were married. But he didn't tell anybody. He didn't tell anybody? He didn't tell on his own sister Sarah and his uncle Lot, uncle Abraham? That was his greatness? He just put his life out for the people of these angels that came to Sodom. And for what reason was he saved? He didn't tattletale. But it's so brilliant. Why? Because Chesed, giving of himself, was something that he was trained to do. But we know the aspect that marks Lot is the concept of greed, and that's a theme that runs throughout the Torah. In Egypt, he had the opportunity of cashing in big. He knew a state secret. I mean, he could have made a mint on this. That's where his struggle was. On the one hand, loads of money. On the other hand, loyalty. And the fact that he chose loyalty over loads of money, when loads of money was something that was really driving him throughout his life, it's for that struggle that he was rewarded. And this, says the Mechtam Eliyahu, Rav Dessler Zatzal, is really the essence of what we're speaking about. Things that we grew up to do, it's really not on our credit account. It's on those who taught us. Our credit account is taking now the next step. How do we move further? And that's why in summation he says in 35, happy is the one who uses all that has been given him by his upbringing as a springboard and whose ambition is to rise to ever more elevated levels in deeds and devotion. That's the key. The key is lo anachnu, we are his, which means that we're not going to take for granted our relationship with him and say, well, I do this mitzvah, I do that mitzvah, and I'm very complacent, I'm very happy. Lo anachnu ve'elu, it's much harder, is to take an honest look at these things and say, is mediocrity enough? Or do I desire an intimate relationship with God, a close relationship with him, that which I do, I want to do better. I want to put more of self into it. Lo anachta. Subjugating our ego to God and taking the positive, that which we do, and bringing it closer to God. At this point, when I was preparing, I then asked myself, okay, sounds like two nice ideas. How do we bring this to a level of the practical? How do we take this and do something in Elul that's going to help us to reach these levels? So Thursday night, I took a poll of everyone I spoke to on the phone. And I asked them, it's a random poll, whoever called. And I asked them the following question. What do you do in Elul to make Elul special? So I got very interesting answers, which I'd like to share. I got the answer, which is a minhag of many, is to add some kapitel tehillim, some psalms every day. Very nice. Another person said to me that they study the Gerut HaRamban, very, very famous letter that the Ramban, Nachmanides, wrote to his son. It's written up by Rabbi Feuer in English, A Letter of All Ages, which is divided up into 30 sections, one for each day of the month. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to do with a family around the table. Also an excellent suggestion. A third person told me that there's a book by Rabbi Bliskin, My King, My Father, My King, and How to Get Closer to God. Also a wonderful suggestion. I think perhaps the best suggestion was a friend of mine who's told me, that's none of your business. What I do is between me and God. And everyone knows what to do in our world. That's such a silly question. Everyone knows what to do. You don't have to ask that question. That's another approach. The approach of the Sfarim, of the books that I read, was basically one answer that came through over and over again, and that was learn Musar, learn ethical works. It reminded me of the famous story of a man who says, I only have 15 minutes a day. What should I study? He asked his rabbi. Should I study the Torah, the Talmud, the Mishnah? I only have 15 minutes. So his rabbi says to him, you should study Musar, ethical work. He says, I only have 15 minutes. There are much more things important than ethical works, the Torah, the Talmud, Jewish law. So I said, no, you don't understand. If you study Musar for 15 minutes, you will realize you have more than 15 minutes to study every day. So there's a value in studying Musar. Having said all of this, I would like to present a fifth option to all of these options. And again, each and every individual will choose that which relates to them and what speaks to them. It's an option which is brought down in the Siva Shalom, the concept of, and this is source 36, Bechol drachecha da'ehu, in all of your ways, get to know God. And the Yaakov Lechav Tov develops this idea and develops it very beautifully. And he says, and I'm going to summarize sources 37 through 41 right now. He says, what does it mean, Bechol drachecha da'ehu, v'hu yasher chosecha, in all your ways, you should know God, and he will strengthen and straighten your path. It means that for whatever you need in life, turn to God and ask him for help. It means that you don't only have a relationship with God when you pray or when you say a blessing, but b'chol drachecha da'ehu, in all your ways know God, v'hu yasher chosecha, means he's on call 24 hours a day. And the example that the Yaakov Lechav Tov brings, and I'll just develop it, brings a slightly different example, but the same point. You're all dressed up. You're going to a brunch, a tea, whatever it is. You're wearing a blue suit. You have everything put together. You look perfect. The only problem is you can't find your blue shoes. The red ones come out, and the black ones come out, and the purple ones, and the polka dot ones, whatever you have in your house, they all come out. The blue shoes do not come out. And you're going frantic. It's running late. We all know the story. We've all had it. At this moment, Bechol drachecha da'ehu means very simple. Turn to God and say, God, I need these blue shoes. Please help me find them. That's what it means. And then, when you find those blue shoes, because ultimately you do find those blue shoes, you say thank you. And that's a relationship with God. When you lose your keys, while you're going frantic around the house looking for them, pause for a moment and say, God, please help me find these keys. And when they're found, usually they are, you say, thank you, God, for helping me find these keys. This, although it seems so trite and trivial, since the Yaakov Lechav Tov develops what we call an emunah chushit, a living faith with God, a living relationship with God. Because God is brought into my life on a very real level. And then, if God's brought into my life on a real level, it's the blue shoes and the keys, you can't get more real than this. So then I've begun to develop a friendship, a closeness with God. And when that happens, it's easier for me to then, when I say a blessing, or when I'm at a struggle of wills, to bring God much more into the picture than otherwise. It's a collect call rather than a long distance call. It's a local call. He's there. He's very much a part of my life. So, on this level, Elul means closeness with God, making God a reality in our lives, and deepening our relationship with Him. Now I'd like to get to the second question of the Ani, the individual. Why the focus on the individual? And this is very important. Because, as the Ali Shur points out in Source 43, the Mishnah says, Rosh Hashanah kol ba'ei ha'olam omdim lefanav kibnei maron. On Rosh Hashanah, we all stand in front of God like bnei maron, which is understood on three levels, the most famous of which is like a sheep being counted. Explains the Ali Shur, when we stand in front of God on the Day of Judgment, there is no hiding. We can't hide behind a spouse, we can't hide behind children, we can't hide behind friends, we can't hide behind our work. It's us. And there's no one to blame and nobody to hide behind, but it's the individual who meets up with God. And this perhaps is best illustrated in the famous Gemara of an individual called Eliezer ben Dardai, who the Gemara tells us, the Talmud tells us, committed every terrible sin in the world imaginable. I mean, he was on the top 10 of sinners. And at one point in time, a prostitute told him, there's no hope for you, you're a goner. And that statement awakened such a passion within him that he ran out to the fields and he says, and this is brought down in Source 44, he says, Harim ugvos bikshu alai rachamim. Mountains and hilltops, pray for me. Shamayim and aretz, pray for me. And then when he realized that nobody could pray for him but himself, he broke down crying and he says, Ein hadavar talui elavi, it's up to me. And he died in the midst of his tears. The voice from heaven comes out and says, Rabbi Eliezer ben Dardai, using the name of Rebbe, have entered the world to come. Very fascinating piece of the Talmud. I'd like to just focus in on this concept of when he asked the hilltops and the mountains, the Shamayim and the Aretz, to pray for him. So explains the Siftei Chaim in source number 45. What does this mean? He says, let's do it in sign, Kivo Shel Adam, it's the nature of a person, where it's underlined, Kisheino Smar Ratzomi Matzavo HaRuchani, when he's not satisfied with his spiritual level, Noheku Lashkida Matzpuno, he calms his conscience, V'liblota Tadabar B'tzibotono, and he blames it on an outside factor. Ilu Hayali Chaver Tov, if I had a good friend, a Chavrusa Tova, a good study partner, Shachen Tov, a good neighbor, Hayiti Lomei Tov, then I would be able to learn better. U'bemet Ein Elu Ela Teutzim, these are only excuses. Matzav Zeh Misukan Ad Ma'od, and this is very dangerous, because you lack any responsibility on yourself. You blame everyone else. In fact, there are some that explain that the Harim and the Gavos, the mountains and the hilltops, we know is always imagery, or frequently in the Torah, for one's parents. Don't blame me, it's my parents who made me the way I am. It's my environment, it's my schooling, it's my society. I had this yesterday after I gave the shiur. A young woman said to me, I'm in my late 30s, I'm not married. If I were married and I had children, then I could have a close spiritual relationship with God. But since God wanted me to be this way, there's no way I can have a relationship with Him. And this is exactly what the Siftei Chaim is saying one cannot say. God gives every individual the kelim, the vehicles and the vessels with which to serve God. What one should not say is, well, if I only had, you don't have it. You may have it one day. Yirtzeh Hashem, you will have it. But the fact is that right now you don't have it, so let's deal with right now. With right now, how are you going to be able to have a relationship with God? And that's the ani l'dodi. Each individual has to look at themselves and say, where I am at and who I am, how am I having a relationship with God? And if one is constantly going to be looking for outside things and outside excuses and not focus in on self, then one's walking up a very dangerous path. I'd like to share a personal story that happened over the last few weeks that really brought this point home to me. We spent the last 3 weeks in Eretz Yisrael. Baruch Hashem, my parents lived there, my sister and her family lived there, so it was really a family reunion. And the other reason that we went to Israel, or I went to Israel, is I said to my husband, I said, this has been years since I've been teaching without a break, and I am depleted. There is nothing left in me. So I am coming to fill up. And I brought suitcases full of empty suitcases just to be filled with spiritual inspiration. And I was going to fill it to the max. And if I had to go out and buy more boxes to fill them up, my Tova, my night. So I went through the what we'd call the typical mode of how do you fill yourself up with spirituality. Began off at the Kotel on Tu B'Av, which is a very holy day, at Vasikin, the sunrise minyan, which is probably the holiest time at the Kotel. I invite everyone, if you want, a very special experience. It's where everyone daven Shemoneh Esrei, the silent prayer, at the same moment, where all the minyanim at the Kotel stop. And there's a silence that's so powerful and so eerie that I invite all of you to taste it once in your life. At the Kotel Friday night, for Shabbos, for Rosh Chodesh Elul, at Kefir Rochel. I'm not going to go through my whole itinerary, but we'll get the idea. Went through all these experiences and said, wow, this will fill you up, fill you up for years with spiritual rejuvenation. And we know everyone responds to these spiritual experiences differently. Toward the end of my visit, I spoke to a friend of mine and I confided in her. And I said, those suitcases are coming back empty. They were nice experiences, they were spiritual experiences, but I needed something that was going to carry me for years to come. I mean, I'm really disappointed in myself that here I have, was all ready for this, and I failed. So my friend, who's really a chaver nefesh, who really knows me very well, said to me the following. She said, Shira, go back home. Go back to California and prepare a shir. And when you prepare a shir, you will find the spirituality you're looking for. And she's right. You prepare a class. Prepare one of these classes. And I thought about this Gemara when she told me this. Because so often in life, we say, if only I were, and since I wasn't, so I can, so I'm depleted, so what do you want from me? In life, ani l'dodi v'dodi li means that we need, each individual needs to find what is it that's going to connect them with God. What is it that's going to speak to them? What is it that's going to rejuvenate them? And if we can't find anything and we blame it on everything around us, we've missed the mark. Elul is that opportunity of saying, what is it that inspires me in my relationship with God? So what we've seen before I respond to the third question about the cities of refuge, what we've seen about Elul is that Elul is such a beautiful time. It's a time of lo anachnu. It's a time where we look at our ego and say, is it too big? Look at our relationship with God and we see who's winning in the battle of wills. And it's also a time which is far more difficult to look at that which we are doing right and saying our relationship could be improved. We could have a closer relationship with God. We could have a more elevated relationship with God. We're satisfied with mediocrity and we should change it. And it's a time to look at self and say, how am I as an individual relating to God? Not to blame it on other factors, but to really take a hard look at myself and who I am. If we are successful with this in Elul, so then something very powerful happens. We've created for ourselves a little asylum called Elul. If we were to leave it in Elul only, so then we've missed the boat. And this brings us back to the Ir Miklat. Why was it necessary on the last page to have these cities of refuge when everyone's going to be on a high spiritual level? So Rabbi Miller quotes in Source 50, in Messianic times, the Israelites will have no desire to kill or to do evil at all. Just because he has acquired the saintly quality, the Torah commands us to designate extra cities of refuge so that there may be in every locality of the enlarged land of Israel a city that will remind man of the efforts he must maintain in order to prevent blood from being shed. Moving to the end of 50, in Messianic times, the preclusion from sin will be complete. The provision of cities of refuge will be a factor ensuring this end. Why was there these cities of refuge? To remind the person of where he's come from. To remind the person of what could happen if you do not maintain this level. Which explains the Meshech Chachmah so deeply. When we bring the Mashiach, not when it happens its own time, but when we bring it, Achishenem. So we've achieved a level on our own, that's when we need these extra cities of refuge to remind us not to fall to where we were. And I think on a similar level, this is what Elul does for us. What Elul does for us is it reminds us during the year where we can achieve. Just like the Yermiklat is a symbol of saying don't fool, the Yermiklat is a symbol, the Elul is a symbol for us where we can arrive. I think the best example that comes to my mind is a battery charger. You know, like we have on these cordless phones? So usually between phone calls we put it into the set. So it's like Shabbos and Yom Tov through the year we recharge. But what does it really mean for the phone to really work? It needs an overnight in the charger. Elul becomes that battery charger for us. And the most important thing to remember is that when Elul's over, don't think, oh, I had a nice, wonderful spiritual experience in Elul, and I felt the closest to God, and I brought him into my life, and I realized that I, as an individual, need to have a relationship with him. But when it comes Tevet, when it comes December, when it comes August, when it comes the middle of the year in April, and I'm feeling low, and I'm feeling distant from God, so then I need to remember Elul and use it like the Tefillah Miklat as a symbol of saying, I can achieve much more. And I can put myself back into that mindset of Elul. And that's perhaps one of the deeper meanings in Source 52, when the Torah describes the city of the Yermiklat, uses the verse, Asher lo tzidav Elokim inal liyado v'samti lecha makom asher anu shama. Again, these letters, inal liyado v'samti lecha, the first letter of each of these four words spells out Elul in describing the Yermiklat. Elul on one level is the city of refuge, which is on this level a reminder. The Yermiklat was a reminder in the future that you shouldn't fool. Elul's reminder for us where we can achieve. And if we're able to take Elul and use it right, and then use Elul throughout the year to spark us, to recharge us, so then we're able to accomplish on the deepest level, Ani l'dodi v'dodi li, I am to my beloved, I have a relationship with my beloved, I'm able to turn to him, and even when I feel distant, I have built into the system something called Elul, to remind myself of this month, of how I felt so close to him, how I've worked so hard on the relationship with him, and wherever I am, and whatever situation I'm in, I turn to the Elul of the Yermiklat to remind me, to boost me, so that I have this closeness with God, and then we should merit v'dodi li, then God responds in kind, comes down and meets us with this intimate relationship.